Okay, Tim. Okay. We'll go a few minutes later on 7:16, 7:17. Give us time to get up from Arif. Okay, Gemara. You guys have sheets? Sheets, guys. Pass sheets to the other side. Gemara. Then when you finish, Yoni, please put them over there so people who come in late can grab a sheet. A Gemara, which Rav Amital Zichrona Levracha would quote us almost every year. I imagine you may have heard about this Gemara. If you have, I apologize for repeating it, but hopefully I'll be able to add some insights and slants on the Gemara. If you haven't heard of the Gemara, it's a very, very powerful Gemara. It's anyone who's been through this yeshiva has heard this Gemara, has heard of Amital quote it. It's Gemara Navot Azara Daf Yud Zayin. Let's take a look at it, try to glean whatever insights we can about tshuva. And the rest of the shiur also will be Osek in tshuva as the week of tshuva begins. Vatanya, Amar Lav Rav Elazar ben Dordaya. This was a Rebbe, one of the members of Chazal, Rav Elazar ben Dordaya. Shelo hiniach zona achas ba'olam shelo ba'aleha. Person who was a Baal Taiva, had an overwhelming Yetzer Hara, and every single zona that was known to man, he had visited. This is a person who had fallen far, had fallen. Let's read this Gemara with maturity. Obviously, it's not something to take in an immature fashion. And Pam achas shama sheyesh zona achas bekrachei hayam. Suddenly he hears that there's some zona far away, some distant land. V'haisen otelas kis dinarim bischar. She was the most expensive zona known to man. She would take an entire pocket, entire sack of gold coins for her charge, for her contract. What made Elazar ben Dordaya so intrigued by the zona in Krachayan? The local zonas weren't attractive enough to him. Local zonas couldn't satiate his desire. It speaks a little bit to whoever opened the door. Please close it, Adam. Please close the door. Tells us a little bit about the nature of chet. The nature of chet. Sometimes our desires are tethered to the sense of adventure. And we're just trying to break the boredom. Things that seem exotic and distant and fantasy and far beyond have a greater appeal on us. Sometimes when we feel bored in life, we're looking for something to break that boredom. And we don't always break our boredom with content. We sometimes break it with chet that comes enveloped or wrapped in adventure. Something about this zona, she was exotic. She was unknown to him. And that flared his taiva. Because he was bored with the local zonos. He was bored with all of the taivas that he had engaged in and indulged in locally. Somehow there was adventure that called him, fantasy, something unexpected, something beyond. How often do we fall victim to chatoim that are product of curiosity? How much in our society do we trumpet curiosity, intellectual curiosity, thirst for knowledge, exposure, encounter with the other? And then when someone says, curiosity killed the cat, and you have to draw red lines, and you can't expose yourself to everything, you can't just look at everything and anything because you're bored, oh, that person's a caveman, that person's a Neanderthal, that person's narrow-minded. It's a real question today. It's a real question, because the boundaries between healthy interaction and unhealthy and toxic interaction, between healthy exposure and healthy images, very, very noxious and harmful images, there's no boundary. It's just a click away. So at some point, we have to make our own boundaries. We have to draw our own red lines. Sometimes we're not really good at drawing red lines because we sacrifice so much of our purity. Even if we aren't drawn and we aren't attracted by all the things that our curious encounters expose us to, it just creates filth, creates an adulteration. When you dive into HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'tayar libeinu li'avdecha b'emes, you think about all the things your eyes have seen and all the things your ears have heard, all the words, all the images, all the conversations, even if you aren't taken by it, even if it doesn't worm its way into your consciousness, even if you're able to, take a sheet, Josh, please. Even if you're able to, guys, where are the sheets? Moshe, you want to be in charge of giving out sheets? Even if you're able to withstand this, the impact of these images, give Moshe the sheets, give the impact of these images, these are still images, sounds, ideas, words, that adulterate and tarnish your neshama. Lokai neshama shenasata bitarhi, neshama that came down from the Kisya Kavod. as it makes its way through this earth and through this world, gets exposed to so much adulteration and so much tarnishing. So where do you draw the line? So often we're bored and we're just looking to satisfy or break our boredom. Right? So many internet sites are explicitly dedicated to breaking boredom. Explicitly dedicated to breaking boredom. Bored.com, I don't know if there's a site, but bored.com. And how much of our chatam is because we can't contain our curiosity and our interest just to look at what's happening beyond our natural world? And it's a natural balance between exposure and between what one could call isolation. I know a lot of people, when they're discussing their college plans, so very often they'll tell me, well, which college are you planning to go to? I say, well, you know, my entire life I've grown up as a Jew and I've been in a Jewish setting. I've only lived with Jews. I want to go to a non-Jewish college because I want to learn to live with Goyim. I want to see what Goyim were like. And I didn't go to any secular settings. I grew up in a Jewish education, Jewish environment, went to a Jewish college. You know what I realized? They're like me. They're human beings. They have one nose, two eyes. They breathe the same oxygen. You treat them with respect. You get treated with respect. Never felt the need to go learn, like as if I was in some National Geographic program in the outer backwards of Australia trying to see how the Aborigines live. They're human beings. Like, there are many reasons to choose colleges, many reasons to choose your path in life, where you want to live, education and level and testing and preparing yourself for profession. There's an overwhelming sense that you have to learn how the other people live. You have to assume that most human beings are like you. At their core, they're good people. They process our world the same way we process our world. See, religiously, there are differences. But when I encounter people that I don't have common background with, I don't automatically assume differences. I automatically assume similarities, and I try to find the common ground. And more often than not, that attempt to find the common ground is pretty successful. I mean, very few people have called me a bigot or racist based on the way I sit on planes or the way I interact with them. So something tugged at Elizabeth Ben Dordaya. Something about this prostitute. She was far. She was across the seas. It was an adventure. She was beyond the here and now. So much of our chatayim are based on this fantasy. So much of our world dresses up people. Sometimes they have these, you know, stars that everyone adores and adulates, and then you see them before they've been photoshopped and before the pictures, and it's just like you and me. They're not abnormal human beings. They aren't the subject or the objects of our desires and our craving. It's just normal, like us, flesh and blood, bones and skin. And so much of our chataim is when opportunities and experiences come dressed as things which they aren't. It's this fantasy which clothes mundane experiences and adds glitter to them and adds shine to them and adds something exotic to them. Feel like there's something special there. We lose our minds. Elizabeth Ben Dordaya, who had already lost his mind even further. He has to travel to the unknown. He has to travel on that adventure. He has to travel to that fantasy world. Something that's calling him, that's different than the humdrum day-to-day, which he's already bored with. So he makes a decision. Source number one, line three. Natal kis dinarim. He takes a pocket of gold. V'halach v'yavar la'shiv v'naharos. And he travels seven rivers, seven oceans. This is something sometimes we're given the opportunity. Right? Al-chayt shechatanu lefanacha beraglayim ha-mamharos, slahara. We're going to say in Mirtz Hashem and Yom Kippur. Al-chayt that we sin because we run. Sometimes we run and immediately we have opportunities for chayt and we just wish that if we had a little more time or two or three jumps or 10 minutes to get to the chayt, somehow we would have avoided it. But sometimes we're just so earnest and so persistent and so dedicated to finding that craving, that which we covet, that desire, that we can spend hours and hours chasing things. And we have all the time in the world to just pull back and change our minds and retain our sanity and regain our normalcy. And we just find that Rav Elazar ben Dordaya, lahavdil, Rav Amital would always tell us about the Akedah, that what made the Akedah unique is that Avram didn't perform this great heroic act in a moment of ecstasy or euphoria. People can do crazy things in a moment of intoxication. They can pull the trigger and blow themselves up. Avram had 3 days. 3 days he travels to Har Moriah. 3 days he thinks about it. 3 days he davens. According to the Medrash, he actually davened to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to rescind the command. We think that Avram accepted his marching orders and just performed it. No, he was morally troubled. It's morally troubled. How could HaKadosh Baruch Hu expect me to murder my own son? But he still performed HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. But he was davening, please HaKadosh Baruch Hu, relieve me from this moral conflict. Please HaKadosh Baruch Hu, rescind your chayt. your command. What did we say this morning? Misha'ana le'Avram Avinu b'Har HaMoriah hu yanenu. Avram stands at Har HaMoriah and he davens to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the tzivui to be rescinded. So lahavdil, the Akedah proved that a person can love HaKadosh Baruch Hu so deeply that not in a moment of ecstasy or intoxication or lunacy to pull the trigger or flip the switch or do something crazy and loony, but 3 days of thought, 3 days of contemplation, I love HaKadosh Baruch Hu so deeply that I prefer his command to what my own moral instinct suggests to me. Lahavdil, you see the inverse here. If Loza ben Dordaya had traveled to the zone and his back, okay, he was overcome. He was overcome by a taiva. He was overcome by sexual hormones. This is someone who travels with determination, travels with persistence, seven oceans to find the zona. Bishas Haragel Davar. So Loza ben Dordaya finds the zona, and he gets engaged and he starts to involve himself in this encounter. Bishas Haragel Davar Heficha. All of a sudden, the Zona reminds Reb Elazar ben Dordaya that she's just a body, that she's just a human being, that all the fantasy can dress her up as some goddess, as some object of desire. And I use the word object in both senses, object of desire, and unfortunately in our world, the objectification of women. She's just a body, like your body, like my body. Kadosh Baruch Hu fashioned that body intentionally to be attractive in the right context for a man and his wife. But in the end, it's just flesh and bones. And what reminded Blessed Ben Adiah, which shattered that fantasy, shattered that hallucination almost. And every chait is a moment of hallucination. What shattered that hallucination is simply she let off some bodily waste or some bodily discharge that every person, every human being has to, every homeostatic, every microorganism has to let off its waste. Every amoeba, every paramecium has to deal with the waste, which are the byproducts of energy and of consumption. So all of a sudden, that little gas, to make it vivid so that you'll know what the Gemara is referring to, was more powerful to Belezva ben Dordaya than all the Musar Shmuzin and all the chastise and rebuke that he undoubtedly heard from his Rebbeim, from his colleagues, for all those years that he was engaged and involved in every single Zona. Amra. So this Zona, interestingly enough, translates it for him. I'll make it very clear to you, she says. Source number 1, line 4. Kishem she'ficha zu eina chazeres l'mkoma. The gas that I discharge can't be retrieved. Once it's discharged, it leaves. Kach Elazar ben Dordaya ein mekablin oso b'tshuva. Your fate is also sealed. Just like this gas is irretrievable, your fate is also unredeemable. And you're finished. But listen to Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya's response. He doesn't take his fate as a fait accompli. He doesn't feel that he's a condemned man, because it's impossible. The Rambam talks about different character traits, which are deterrents to tshuva. And even worse character traits, which almost make it impossible to perform tshuva. He talks about 24 things, dramakiv tshuva, nechas tshuva. And he talks about 5 things that are even worse, that are no limis haderech lebnei tshuva. They're not just ma'ake, they don't just deter, but they lock tshuva. But they don't eliminate tshuva. They lock tshuva, and once tshuva is locked in a cell, or more appropriately, you're locked in a cell, it's harder, but you can always find a way out. The Gemara in Chagiga says that Elisha ben Avuya, the great heretic, Rabbi Meir's Rebbe, heard a baskol, and the baskol said that everyone can perform tshuva except for the baskol ended, because it's an impossible sentence to finish, because there is no person who is removed and cut off from tshuva. But he heard everyone can perform tshuva except for Elisha ben Avuya. You know why he heard it? Because he wanted to hear it. Because it's cathartic to assume that you've fallen so far, that you've fallen off the grid, that you've lost your opportunity, and then you're released. You're released from responsibility. You're released from religious pressure. You're released from tshuva. I'm sure a lot of you are looking for that release. A lot of people are looking, not that dramatic, chas v'shalom, but a lot of people, deep, deep in your hearts, if you're really honest with yourself, and you have to be honest with yourself, because that's the first stage. Rav Amital taught us all the time. Be honest with yourself, That's the first stage of tshuva. Don't try to make yourself into more tzaddik than you really are. Be honest with what you're thinking. How many of you are really, 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 really waiting for Matzah Shabbos, for Ne'ilah, for that shofar sound, to get through, get finished with this, so I can get back to normal life? That all this pressure and waking up early and heat and religious scrutiny and fasting. I just want the relaxed life. I want the casual. I want to enjoy myself. So I'll make it through Yom Kippur. I'll plug through. I'm a serious guy. I'm not going to break away from Yom Kippur. I told you earlier in the year, when you're young, your happiest day in the year is Yud Aleph Tishrei, and your most intense and dreaded day of the year is Tes Tishrei. Yud Aleph Tishrei comes, you're thrilled. I don't have to go through that for another year. I don't have to go through that for another year. And Tes Tishrei, you're feeling the pressure, you're feeling the heat. Oh my goodness, Yom Kippur's here. I promise you that when you mature religiously, some people it's when you become an adult, some people prior to becoming an adult, some people even when you're an adult, I promise you, this is the happiest time of your life. It's the most intense time. You know you're alive. You're carving your identity. You're facing yourself honestly. You're facing your mortality. Mortality gives meaning to life. Death gives meaning to life. Connotations and consequences give meaning to life. It's not just open-ended. You read about all those people in Sefer Bereishis, the Sefer we're going to start in a few weeks, who lived 500 years, 600 years, 700 years. They had children after 130 years. It's no wonder they're moral degenerates. It's no wonder they worship planets. It's no wonder they drank each other's blood. Because there's no moral compass, because it's endless. There's no accounting. There's no code. There's no responsibility. You live endlessly. You see people who live absolutely affluent. They have no care in the world. And you see how quickly and how precipitously they fall. The natural checks and balances that Hashem gave us are healthy to human condition. And you reach that stage where you spend 24 hours in Shemayim, I could promise you, your biggest enemy on Yom Kippur this year, your biggest enemy will be Sunday. Try your hardest not to think about Sunday. Because that's a psychological release from the pressure of Yom Kippur. Facing the pressure, facing the intensity, you're facing the heat, you're facing the tefillos, you're facing the honesty, but deep, deep, deep in the back of your mind, you know that in 5 hours, in 6 hours, in 10 hours, it's going to end. And life as we know it, with all of its normalcy, will return. That's a release. That's a walk away. That's an escape mechanism. That's fleeing. That's taking refuge in Sunday from the heat of Shabbos. You know what you should really think? Imagine that the world's going to end Matzei Shabbos. Imagine your world's going to end Matzei Shabbos. That's already a very morbid thought. Imagine who you are. You're going to enter the next world on Yom Kippur. Or the world's going to end, and it's not going to be a Sunday. So you just have Yom Kippur as a terminus. And that's going to determine your character, your meaning, your identity. That's going to determine who you are. You have to trick yourself into that. Because that will shut off Sunday as a release valve and allow you to channel all your focus and all your attention to Shabbos. Because you make believe Sunday doesn't exist. Now we all know Sunday will probably exist. But can you convince yourself that you're in it independent of Sunday? And the real stakes are who you're going to become on Shabbos and how much purity and cleansing and how much transcendence you'll achieve on Shabbos. That's why time is a very tricky thing. Even now, as much as you're listening, some are listening more, some are listening less, you know that at 7:20 it's going to end. So you're listening contextualized. Time is contextualizing the intensity of your investment. If you knew that this year would last forever and you weren't beholden to time, your bodies weren't weak, your minds weren't weak, you weren't hungry, you'd be listening now with an intensity that would usurp and supersede any level of attention you're paying right now. Because at some level, as humans, we all do that. We're factoring in the entire biorhythm of our experience. And we know that in an hour, we'll be sitting and eating, and to a degree, everything we're thinking now, everything we're engaged in now will be tempered. Time tempers us. Sometimes you have to defeat time. Sometimes you have to live outside of time. To me, that's one of the great challenges of Yom Kippur. Shatter time. Not just about not eating, not just about not drinking. But people that come over to me, adults, I give Shabbos Shuvah drushes in the Yishuv, who remind me that I said this 10 years ago. So I'll say this to you, maybe in 10 years you'll come back and say, I say this every Yom Kippur. There must be hundreds, thousands of people who have heard me say this. They say, those who try it, it's one of the most helpful parts of the Yom Kippur. Here's practical advice for Yom Kippur. A lot of what I say is theoretical, existential, emotional, metaphoric. This is real. You want to really succeed on Yom Kippur? Go beyond the not drinking. Go beyond the not eating. Go beyond the davening. Go beyond the fasting. Go beyond the alchet. Because it's so institutionalized, it can be very artificial. You just go through the motions. And even if you're sincere, it can be tempered. You really want to make it deep and intense? Here's a trick. Walk in on Yom Kippur to the Beis Medrash. Take your watch off and put it in your pocket for 25 hours. You'll be shocked at the fabric of a Yom Kippur. Because so many people spend so much time in Yom Kippur watch gazing. Okay, I've already fasted 5 hours. That means I have 20 hours left. Let's see, 10% gone, 90% still, 3.5, 6.2, fractions, percentages, how much time. We all do it. We all do it. I did it also until I learned this trick. It's human nature. And you're running away. And even if you're not running away like a coward, I'm not saying anyone's a coward, I'm going to run away from Yom Kippur, I'm going to hide in my room under my covers. Psychologically, you're balking. Psychologically, you're flinching. Don't flinch. Thrust yourself into the intensity of Yom Kippur with all your mental energy, with all your emotional strength. And this is your enemy. Because this brings you back to Sunday. This reminds you it's going to end. What would happen if you knew Yom Kippur wouldn't end? That you're davening on Yom Kippur could pierce the heavens and change history and bring Mashiach. It's an incredible thought. And I said it the other way, morbid, because sometimes what it means to bring Mashiach. But what would it be like if you knew that Yom Kippur were the end? This were your last Yom Kippur. It'd be a whole different experience. You'd be freed from time. You'd be unfettered by the handcuffs of temporal existence, that I have to live in time and qualify my experience in time. See how much of that you can reach. See how much of that you can achieve. You'll find yourself at some point, maybe in Shacharis, not knowing what time it is, Musaf, not knowing what time it is, Mincha being swept up in the panic of the Yud Gimel Midos of the Mincha, beyond time, not caring about food, not caring, and then you're really hitting the core of existence. Who am I? What am I? Not running away, facing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what do I want for myself? So, Elisha ben Avuhi ran away. He heard that Baskol say everyone can do tshuva, except for Elisha. Elazar ben Dardai didn't run away. He was told by the Zona that you're lost, and he could have very easily have assumed there was an omen. I traveled seven seas to this Zona. What are the chances that a Zona is going to do something so disgusting and unappealing? And she's a professional. What are the chances? It's a sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that I have no choice and no chance. No, he refused. He believes in tshuva. He believes in freedom of choice. David HaMelech writes an entire sefer. Could you imagine writing a sefer about how embarrassed you are of who you are and spilling your heart out and telling the entire world and generations all the monstrous things you've done? David HaMelech does it. Because he's fighting for people to believe in tshuva. Our problem is we believe too much in tshuva. We have so many precedents to tshuva, and it's so institutionalized that we just sink into it like it's part of our schedule. Spring is for house cleaning, and the fall is for moral inventory and soul cleaning. It's a time to do tshuva. We all feel the songs, the weather. Apologize to the Southern Hemisphere guys. You know, the weather, it's turning. It's now time to get a little more serious. Klap al chait. Improve. It's too sterile. It's too clinical for us. It's too planned. It's too premeditated. Tshuva has to come with shock, with grief, with shame, with horror, with frustration, with anger. There's so many emotions that tshuva, and if you read Tehillim, you see all of them. And it can't just be a calm, quiet process, like Lahavdil New Year's resolutions. It's the new year. Let me take some resolutions to improve. It's abhorrent to turn tshuva into New Year's resolutions. It's abhorrent. Tshuva is a shock to your system. Ezra says, I can't pick up my head because I'm ashamed. Not at myself. Ezra says, Ein lanu pe laharim rosh. Boshti v'nechlamti. I'm embarrassed because this people who've come back from Bavel still haven't divorced their Gentile wives in Ezra, Perek Tes. It wasn't even Ezra. this people. I'm embarrassed to be a representative of this people. We've shown them so many miracles. And in the basic, basic sense of Jewish history, it's not like they're worshiping idols. It's not like they had sexual adventures. It's not like they were married to Gentile wives. Most basic sense of Jewish identity. Whom you are, what your seed is, what your future is. Basics. It's a total, total walk away, turning your back on Jewish history. I'm embarrassed. I can't even stand in front of you. Do you reach the stage in Yom Kippur where you're embarrassed to look at Hashem because you're embarrassed Him to look at you? If you do, then it's a siman, you're doing real tshuva. It's hard for us to even feel what embarrassment is. Do you know what embarrassment is? When's the last time you were embarrassed? We don't get embarrassed too often because we don't really live in a world of honor. People used to live in a world of honor, which they cared authentically, where people thought about them in a virtuous way, in a noble way. I want my name to be solid. I want my word to be respected. I want my profile to be inspiring to people. I care about something larger than myself. People sometimes care today about how people see them. Selfish reasons, because I want to get ahead, because I want to gain some advantage. People used to care about, people used to live in such close precincts that care was real. Today, we live in private defiles and narrow little caves of personal experience. I remember I talked to you earlier this year. I was once talking to a friend of mine from South Africa, an adult, and I said, how do you solve the Iguna problem in South Africa? He started laughing at me. He says, are you kidding me? We don't have an Iguna problem in South Africa. All the Jews in Johannesburg live within a 4x4 mile radius in Johannesburg, a 4x4 mile square radius, and if someone were to refuse to get to his wife, we all shop in the same supermarkets, we all daven in the same shul, we all send our kids to the same school, we see each other, we run into each other 6-7 times a day. No one would dare show his face in public if he was acting so cruelly to his wife. He wouldn't dare show his face in public. He'd be so embarrassed to live, he'd have to walk away from his entire life. Unfortunately, large communal settings of people, train station like experiences, we can hide from each other. We don't have to live in view of each other and in moral companionship with one another, in dignified companionship with one another. So it's hard for us to generate busha. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was about to die, the Gemara says in Brachos, his Talmidim came in to see him. And they said, Rabbi, give us one last bracha. And you know what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the fame of Yochanan ben Zakkai's bracha was to his Talmidim? Told his Talmidim, I hope that you fear Hashem as deeply as you fear Basar Vadam. And they were shocked. What? Yirat Shamayim should be greater than fearing people. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as he was dying, told his Talmidim, I just wish that you'd be as embarrassed in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as you are in the presence. How many things that you do would you be embarrassed if people saw you do them? Many. And that sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence, we don't have. Unfortunately, it's very, very surreal. It's very abstract. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was trying to make it, I wish you could materialize HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the same way, just equal. Forget that Yirat Shamayim should be superior. I just wish you should feel embarrassment and shame. So for David HaMelech, it was about proving that Shuv exists. It's a beautiful medrash. I'm sorry to rant, but this. So much, it could be a 5-hour shiur. There's so much to talk about Tshuva. One little shiur doesn't do justice. Adam HaRishon is walking around outside of Gan Eden. Who does he come across? Lo and behold, he comes across his son, Cain. And Cain is happy. And Adam is mourning. The Gemara says that Adam mourned 130 years. 130 years of Avelus. He refused to be with his wife. He subjected himself to Yisurim. Can you imagine mourning 130 years because you sacrificed paradise for yourself and for every single person that ever lived? You brought death. Well, you don't live that same drama, but I do hope that you're starting to get a sense of the drama of your life because the decisions you're going to make during your time in yeshiva are going to affect dozens, for some of you, hundreds of people. Look at yourself. I mean, just, I'm sorry to talk about people specifically here. No, I'm not going to mention anyone's names, obviously. Think about those of you whose parents were in yeshiva 25 years ago, and think about what your Rosh Hashanahs and Yom Kippurs were like, or your Shabbos tables, or similar situations, parents of yours who had yeshiva backgrounds and decisions they made, how much that impacted your life. And those of you who don't have that privilege, think about, okay, so your parents didn't have that opportunity. It's no fault of your own, no fault of theirs, but you now can make that change. Your decisions now are going to ripple and ripple and ripple and ripple. So you're not other Marishon. You're not changing the course of human history, but you are changing your small little part of human history by slight decisions, slight little pebbles, ripple and ripple and ripple and ripple. Slight decisions you made. I keep going back to this only to make it real, not that it should be self-serving. Slight decisions I made, slight decisions your Rebbeim made, impacted their Talmidim, then impacted you, and if you're a Talmidim of our Talmidim, then impacted, going to impact your Talmidim, your children, whoever, the people that are inspired by you. So these slight little ripples start to make major, major shifts, tectonic shifts, in religious history and in moral history. So Adam is mourning for 130 years, and Cain, who conceivably, arguably, committed a graver sin than Adam, is smiling. So Adam asks Cain, why are you so happy? Cain says, because I did tshuva. And Hashem commuted my sentence. Cain did tshuva? Cain did tshuva? Hashem begs Cain to do tshuva. He asks him, in Tetiv lapesachatas rovets, in Tetiv seitz, in lav lapesachatas rovets. He's telling him, it's your choice. If you choose the right way, fine. And if not, sin will follow you to the grave. And you know what Cain says? Three words. Anyone knows Cain's three words? Gadol. Avoni, Miniso? That's tshuva? That's tshuva? He asks Hashem, is my sin too great for you to bear? It's gotta be the ugliest tshuva in the history of man. There's no alchet, there's no accountability, there's no grief. Maybe Chazal filling in, but in the pasuk. But it's a little. Listen to what I'm about to say. This is really, really important. Everything is important. Tshuva is not an all-or-nothing proposition. Even imperfect tshuva is tshuva. It's not all-or-nothing. Don't get frustrated with yourself if your tshuva is imperfect. It's not an all-or-nothing proposition. The Ramban writes, take a look at the Ramban. There's so much to say. Let's go from one source to another. Look at source 5. Source 5 is taken from Parshas Bichul Kosai. That talks about the tshuva of the people in Galus Bavel who returned with Ezra. And we already see that they weren't such tzaddikim. They weren't such pure people. Aside from all the other chatayim. And these were the good ones. These are the ones who came back to Israel. 42,000. Most stayed behind. These are the good ones. And amongst those 42,000, many weren't pedigreed. That's why Ezra had to start filtering them. Which parak in Shas tells us about Ezra filtering all the riffraff that came back from Bavel? The fourth parak in Kiddushin. Asara, Yochsin, Alu, Im Ezra, Mi Bavel. There were 10 different levels of pedigree. Most of them, not all of them, many of them were Mamzerim. Many of them were Shtuki, who didn't know who their father was. Many of them were Asufi, people who were found in the street. Many of them were Halalim. Many of them were Nesinim. Riffraff! So 42,000 people returned. Amongst them, all sorts of non-pedigree people. And amongst the pedigree people, they all had Gentile wives. You get the scene. So the Torah tells about them, they'll be redeemed. Source number 5, V'hisvandu es avonam, they will confess their sins. V'his avon avosam, and the sins of their fathers. B'malam asher malu, the insult they caused me. V'af asher halchem yibikeri, and their inconsistency. So Hashem prophesizes that the Dar Bavel will perform a confession. And that's it. Doesn't say, and their confession will then lead to heartfelt tshuva. The Ramban reads this pasuk literally, source number 6. Gam lo amru, sheyashuvu b'tshuva shleim olefanav. It doesn't say they'll perform a complete and perfect tshuva. Rak, sheyisvadu, avonam, avonam osam. Are you hearing this? Confession alone is meaningful. Not hypocritical confession. Not sanctimonious confession. Not deceitful confession. But even someone that confesses, takarish parchu, think of my sins. You know what? If I were a betting man, I don't even know if I'll be able to. But I just know that I feel terrible about it. I wish I could change. And maybe I can't, maybe some people don't even wish they could change. Unfortunately. But they feel bad about it. I don't know how those two can cohere, but at some psychological level, maybe they can. I feel terrible about it. I don't wish I could change. I don't know how those two can coexist, but at some level, human beings are very complicated. Maybe they can exist. That itself is accepted by Hashem. Just in the act of confessing, just in the act of vidui, and taking chatayim from the abstract netherworld of denial and lending them graphic, vivid detail. Graphic and vivid detail. The Gemara in Ksuvah says, source number 3, when Rebbe died, there was an incredible vacuum. Rebbe was one of the great, great heroes of the Masara. Could you imagine when Rebbe died? Yoni, Adam, Moshe. I stood in Boston in front of the Rav's Kever, not imagining that the world could continue. I remember the street. I don't go to Boston too often, as you know. I remember the street. I remember the day. I remember where the sun was, thinking the world had ended. How could the world continue without the Rav alive? It was. I didn't have the same relationship with when Rav Amital was nifter. It wasn't even intellectual. Like, how could the world continue? I just cried like a baby. I didn't even have the wherewithal to even think about the world. I was just in such shock. I just was crying. I wasn't thinking. The Rav, it wasn't the Rav Shir, but it wasn't the same. This is toward the end of his life. But just standing there and thinking about a world with Erev Soloveitchik, it just, I couldn't imagine it. Can you multiply that multiple times and imagine the people who watched Rebbe die? Can you imagine watching the Rambam die? Watching Rebbe Akiva die? Watching Rebbe die? Unthinkable. What will be the future of Torah? We're going to talk about this on Yom Kippur when we read about the Asarah Gemalchus. What's the future? Who's going to be there? And of course, Torah always proves us wrong. Because Torah is infinite and Torah hovers above humanity. And we talked about last week. So they made the following edict, source number 3. Hahu Yoma Denach Nashe De Rebbe. It's a Gemara in Ksuvos and Rebbe died. Gazur Rabbanan Tanisa. They made a Tanis. Ubay Rachame. And they all davened. And they said, Amri, kol man di amar nach nashe de Rebbe, whoever goes around saying Rebbe's dead, yidakir becherev, he should be stabbed. I didn't mean they're going to stab him, but he... What is this, children's games? If everyone makes believe Rebbe's alive, he's alive. Well, some chassidim take that strategy. Okay, it's not so simple, obviously. Shouldn't mock people that have a lot of depth and thought about it, and never, we don't subscribe to that, okay? We believe people die, and we believe great people die, and obviously they don't believe that people are alive, they just think that their neshamos have meaning, that obviously people aren't into Kabbalah, don't ascribe to it, right? If the Babaji Rebbe says the Rebbe is still alive, based on his Kabbalistic feelings, we don't agree with that, that's not the life we live. If he says he davens to the Rebbe, that's a bodhisattva. So learn the difference. Not every mistake should be treated with equal opposition. Okay, if he says the Rebbe is alive, okay, it means Alpi Kabbalah, right? Well, what does it mean, Alpi Kabbalah? What does the Gilgal mean? Or what does Kabbalah mean? We're not conversant in Kabbalah. We don't dabble in Kabbalah. We have enough to occupy us in the non-Kabbalah world. If he says the Rebbe can do Hagbah, that's already silly, you know, because that's not Kabbalah, that's real. If he says the davening to the Rebbe, that's already Avodah Zarah. So what, all of a sudden, Rebbe's alive, Rebbe's alive, let's fake each other out, let's tell each other Rebbe's alive. No, guys, there's a difference between thinking something, knowing something, and saying it. Words create vivid, graphic reality as opposed to abstract thought. That's why, derech agav, it's so important to have a good vocabulary, to have good words. Because the sharper your words, the sharper your experience. If you have more ways to describe life, you have deeper ways to feel life. Eskimos have 7 words for snow. Because for them, snow is a really important part of their reality. For us, snow, my apologies to Ariel, for us, snow is a sidebar of our life. So we can call it all snow. We don't have to be mechalik between powdery snow and igloo snow and snowball snow and icicle snow and dangerous snow and avalanche snow. If you're a mountain climber, you have to know very, very well the difference between packed snow and slippery snow. We do see life and death. An avalanche will come, you have no choice. So for you, you have to give it different names. You have to process reality more precisely, more sharply. So when we lend words to ideas, they become more graphic, more powerful. So even in the act of being misvada, you're taking ideas which we all deny. We have to deny just to be healthy. If we live with constant awareness of our failures, what would be with our self-esteem, with our sense of purpose, a sense of future and potential? There has to be a natural denial. And hopefully some of those layers of denial get peeled away during this month. And then to a degree, some of those layers of denial get replaced. Only very strong people can live perfectly honest lives without any denial. We all have to shade ourselves in more rosy colors. We all have to see ourselves in better shades, in more favorable terms. Because if we really saw what we did, could you imagine if you lived life every minute with the same clarity of Ne'ilah? There's a moment in Ne'ilah, I'm going to promise you, you're all going to reach clarity that you don't experience the rest of the year. Food has been emptied, drink has been sidelined, pettiness has been removed. Midget, you're now a large person and you see life the way you want to see it, and you say Hashem Elokim with all your energy and with all your sincerity. So if you could really lock in that clarity, then you'd never sin. But what if you saw with that clarity after you sinned? I don't want to say this word, Chas v'Shalom, so sorry. You'd be tormented by guilt. And people that are overwhelmed by guilt are plunged into endless depression. So to a degree, we manage our guilt. To a degree, we live in self-deception, in healthy self-deception, to a degree. And Vidoy's attempt is to try to skim away some of those layers. I know myself, I can't speak, I can only speak for one person in this room. When I start my Al-Chaitz on Yom Kippur, maybe 30% are relevant. You know, I did this. So these, I don't know what they mean. We're going to hand out sheets, you can start to read them in English and Hebrew. I don't know what they mean. Then all of a sudden, you repeat it again and again. And yeah, you know, you know what? I really have that. Some of them are subtle, and then you realize them. Some of them are not subtle, but you're concealing them. And Yom Kippur is the great discloser of reality. Takes away some of those concealed layers. All of a sudden, I start hitting the 90%. You know, some of them, I'm not a money lender, so I don't really, I'm not, I have a hard time, although there's Ribbis Dvarim, so there's all sorts of psychophantic ways we behave, where we want to try to win favor from people, so we do things as psychophants to try to get people to like us more, so that's also Ribbis. So I'm getting closer to 95, 96. That's why we say 10 Vidas. We say 10 Vidas. Won't one Vida be enough? First Vida is literally lip service. And slowly but sure, there's like an endless cycle, right? Because one of the vidui says, "Alchet shechatenot necha bevidui devarim." They were just doing artificial vidui, but that continues to be a chet. Because when we say they were doing artificial vidui, we're artificial about our avoidance of artificial vidui. So we get locked in one of these cycles. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Alchet shechatenot necha bevidui pet. Wait a second, I just did vidui pet. Wait a second, I just did vidui pet. So to break out of that cycle, you got to have some shard of sincerity, some bone of authenticity. So where were we? So even Vida, even imperfect tshuva. A lot of people are tormented. I know that next year I'm going to be the same Baal Chait. So even if you don't, just the act of confession, the act of Vida. Or more than that, can you bring yourself to the pill point? What's the pill point? What's the point of taking a pill? Can you bring yourself to the point where if someone put a pill on the table, tefilas ne'ilah, and if you took that pill, you would magically become fill in the blanks. You become that person religiously, morally, historically. Would you take that pill? If you want to take the pill, then your vidui is sincere. Hashem takes it. Because if I could just lock in this moment and defy human nature, this is who I'd be the whole year. But Hashem, you know us. Emes, atayotzram, ve'atayodea yitzram, kihim basar vadam. You know how you made us. You know that we have yetzaharas. You know that we're frail. You know that we wander. But here I've broken through. And it's my breakthrough moment. And if you give me that pill, this is my real me. Before I have to go back to that world that will cut me down. This is the real me. That's an authentic vidui, and that's an authentic tshuva. And Hashem judges you, Basher Husham. Just like he judged Yishmael, Basher Husham. Hashem knew that Yishmael was going to murder millions of people. But at that moment, there's an innocent, helpless baby, and Hashem answered him, as the Pasuk says in Vayera, Basher Husham. Basher Husham. So we read about it, Rosh Hashanah. So let's get back to Elazar ben Dordaya and finish this story. A little bit of a sidebar. So Elazar ben Dordaya didn't assume that all was lost. Halach v'yashav bein shnei harim v'gvos. He sits between two mountains. Some mefarshim read this metaphorically. Some mefarshim read this literally. They're both the same. Meaning-wise, they're the same. He sits between the mountains. And he says, harim v'gvos bakshu alai rachamim. Source number Aleph, number 1, line 6. He asks the mountains to intercede on his behalf in Davin. Perfectly natural to ask people to daven for you. I ask people all the time to daven for me. I ask dead people to daven for me. When you go to a grave, you're going to a grave for two reasons, primarily. Number one, that the schus of that person should be more accounted for in Shemayim, so Hashem should know that you know, you're living that person's history and you feel connected, and therefore that schus is more relevant to you. Because schios aren't just casino chips that get passed around from hand to hand. Schus is like a glove, it has to fit. So does that schut fit you? And second of all, you can ask a dead person to daven for you in Shemayim. We say that person should be a Melitz Yosha. Because who's davening in Shemayim? People are davening in Shemayim for you. For Am Yisrael. So you can ask people to daven for you. You can ask a Zaidi of yours, a Bubby of yours to daven for you. Kalev goes to Marasa Machpelah and asks the Avos to daven for him before he joins the forces with the Meraglim in Parsha Shlach. He's in Shatech al-Kivri Avos. So Elazar ben Dordaya asks nature to daven for him, asks the universe. And basically, just to cut to the chase, the mountains say, we got our own problems. And they quote a pasuk about the apocalypse where Hashem's going to tear them asunder. We got our own davening to do. Don't look to us. Okay, whether this is metaphoric or not. Those of you who feel this is a little too fantastical to take literally, so it means that he imagined himself davening to the mountains. This is projection. He's looking for people to help him out. Then he goes to the Shemayim Varetz, line number 7. Bakshu alai rachamim, heaven and earth. Shemayim Varetz, quote pasuk of Echvesim Zecharia. Hashem's going to tear us asunder during the apocalypse. We got our own problems. Goes to the Kochavim, daven for me. They can be Kochavim, they can be the broader cosmos, whatever. Everyone says, no mas. Too bad. We got our own tefillos to worry about. Here are the words to take with you. I mean, so many words to take with you for Yom Kippur. He says, Amar, three lines in the bottom, a member of Amital Zechona Levracha, telling us this time and time. It's a great gemara to come back to Erev Yom Kippur. You know, put yourself in the spirit. Talk to you so often, you got to create spirit. These years in yeshiva, we're creating spirit for you. Should read to you some of the emails, some of the Facebooks of young people. You know, how do I get into it? Like, give me something. Give me a video clip. Give me a song from the yeshiva. I'm busy sending, you know, there's a song list of all the yeshivas or Shani Yom Kippur songs and a shir and an online and a slichos and a picture. For everyone, it's different. For some people, it's intellectual. Some people, it's emotional. Some people, it's a song and a picture. Just bring me back. Put me in Yom Kippur. You know, I'm lost and I'm in a world that, you know, it's mundane. It's empty. And I need to have a world of spirit. So Elazar ben Dordaya says, Amar, after he asks the heavens and the earth and the stars, and Amar, he says, Ein hadavar taloi ella bi. It's about me. No one's going to help me unless I help myself. And I am man enough to look this in the eye and to face it and to beat it. Ein hadavar taloi elabi. That's the core of tshuva. The core of tshuva is ein hadavar taloi elabi. We've had 5 or 6 shiurim this ella. I must have said this 5 or 6 times already. I promise you, I'll try not to say it when we come back. There is no theys. Get that word out of your vocabulary. Get the word they out. That is a displacing word that displaces burden, that displaces accountability, that displaces potential, that displaces responsibility. Ein hadavar taloi is no theys. Tshuva is not for them. Gehenna is not for them. Stories I read about is not for them. Religious saga is not for them. It's me, here and now. Here, now, no thems, you. You're dictating your life. You're authoring your reality. The consequences are yours and yours alone. Hashem doesn't predetermine anything. You decide who you'd like to be, who you don't want to be. And when you make those decisions, they're yours to live with, and they're yours to bear the consequences. And this deferral has ended. He tried to defer. When you're young, you try to defer time. And do it later. He wasn't deferring time, he was deferring responsibility. You get old, you can't defer time because you realize more so than when you're young, you may not have time. So you don't play that game of deferring time, but you still defer responsibility. Ain hadavar tali elam bi. What am I doing? I have the ability to daven. I have the ability to plunge into myself and think about who I am. And could you believe this? This is a man who visited every single known prostitute. And he rises up and he riots against his past. And he puts his hands between his legs. Hiniach rosho bein birchav. Ga bivachia. And he cries and he cries and he cries. Ad sheyatzla nishmasa, until he dies. Can you imagine being so heartbroken that you die? It happens. There are people that are so heartbroken, they're so overwhelmed with grief, that emotional destabilization is so overwhelming that it becomes a physical and medical malaise. And they die of a broken heart. Yatzis abaskol. Abaskol came out. The Amra resonated through the heavens. Rabbi Lazar ben Dordaya, Mizuman l'chay olam haba. Could you believe that? Mizuman. He's invited. Didn't just slip in through the back door, Brooklyn style. He's invited. Front door. Invitation. Black tie only. Valet parking. Invited into Olam Haba. That is all it takes. All this work. I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable, but I want to say it for the benefit of people that will have it, to make them feel super comfortable. Don't feel uncomfortable if not, because we say at many points in our davening that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you want tears, we're crying internally. We just don't have the honesty. We're suffocating the tears. We're suppressing the tears. So many people suppress the tears naturally. They don't want to be authentic enough. But if you cry on Yom Kippur, one tear, one little tear, that's a siman in your tefillas and his kabbalah and shemayim. That's a siman that all of them have fallen. All those barriers, all those blockades. Authenticity is there. There's a direct line between your lev and between your mouth. Pivali boshavin. There's an old masara, api kabbalah. And if you have this, you should know the masara. When you cry in Yom Kippur or Shana, you shouldn't wipe away your tears. Don't wipe your tears. That's how you want to appear in front of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Some people even have a minhag api kabbalah. They take their tears and they spread them on their face, because that's api kabbalah, you can achieve tahara. The tears are the way that you mitar yourself, because that's a real breaking of yourself. So if you're not someone that cries, or you don't cry, you don't feel all, where am I? Is my tefillah not authentic? That just means that your tefillah is authentic, but it hasn't expressed itself that way. But internally expressed of other ways, they come to you a different time, come to you in other expressions, more commitment when you come back, better discipline over ben hazmanim. But if you do, think about Lezer ben Dordaya. Don't be afraid. If you feel yourself welling up inside, don't try to hold it in. Don't try to contain yourself. Don't try. That's when HaKadosh Baruch Hu took Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya to Shemayim, even Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya. So you can imagine how lush this Gemara is, how many layers there is, how many lines in each line, and why this is always such a beautiful way for Rabbi Amital, Zechron Levracha, to bring us into the Yom Kippur spirit. And now you have that Gemara that meant so much to us. Hopefully you can take this Gemara with all the other little souvenirs we're giving you. It's really important to collect souvenirs in Yeshiva. I don't mean seats in the base medrash or Rabbi Tarigan Svar. I mean souvenirs, meaning, you know, things that you pull out of your pocket. You know, I'm handing out sheets to the guys in my shir of this. That's Rosh Hashanah. They pull us out my pocket and get myself into the spirit. They can be actual things you pull out of your pocket. They can be songs. They can be mental images. Things that you go back to. You say, oh, that brings me back to where I was. That helps me generate the spirit. It's harder for me to generate now. Everyone have an easy 2 more minutes to the fast. Good. Thank you. Okay, guys, since this is the last shiur, the shiur will resume in Mirtz Hashem.